Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
Now, Pat Nevin, you should be there. Hello.
I certainly am there. I hope you can hear me okay, Joe.
Loud and clear. How you doing?
Very well, very well. Busy day so far. I need to fill you in with a story. Can I fill you in with a story that's nothing got to do with football first?
Pat, I'll be honest, that would be very welcome.
I told you last week about my daughter who works as a doctor, and she's going to be, she's facing the coronavirus. She's frontline, being an FY1 first year doctor. Anyway, she went out for a walk last night up in the hills in Scotland to clear her air a wee bit with her friend, who then fell and dislocated and cracked her ankle the same way as, what's his name from Everton earlier in the season?
Oh, yes. Well, I remember Son. I don't remember who it was.
Yeah, exactly. So his name's escaping.
Gomez.
Gomez, exactly. And so she was stuck up in the mountain in the middle of nowhere with one of her colleagues. Oh, 2 hours. Helicopters, rescue missions, everything. So she's got better stories than me all the time, I tell you. Anyway, seemed good recovery. Had the operation this morning. Seems it's going to be okay, but that's all she needed.
When it rains, it pours. Oh, my God. That is just ridiculous.
I know. I went to see her to make sure she was okay. She was a wee bit in shock for a wee while. Yeah. And honestly, I don't want to get near her. She's not just for the virus, just for anything. She's just not a good person to be near.
Jinxed, yeah.
Coping.
What's your daughter saying of the situation in the hospital over in Scotland? Is it Glasgow she's in or Edinburgh?
Yes, Glasgow, epicentre of it's going to be at that hospital. Funnily enough, it's very quiet at the moment because it's hitting London big at the moment and we are probably a week behind that. So we've got a week or two. So they're expecting it to really hit big over the next 2 weeks. So there are a number of cases here. There have been one or two sad deaths already in Scotland. However, they expect it to really kick on, and that's the expectation. Like everywhere, there's just this, you know, exponential curve that happens over a certain amount of time. So we're expecting the hit. We're a wee bit further away. Just you think about it, we're the northern corner of Europe. So we're going to get it over the next couple of weeks, and it's all preparation for that.
Yes, I think we're in a similar boat. The calm before the storm, although the storm is really nearing now. That's our sense over here.
No, you can feel it. Yeah, you can absolutely feel it around here. I mean, in Glasgow, people are walking about, you know, they are staying apart. The shops are making sure only certain amounts of people come in at the same time. But, you know, it's still semi-normal, as in people aren't being stupid. There's not pubs or anything like that open. All that's shut. Everything's done now. So they've got to where they should be in that. And people, in the general way, are kind of behaving fairly well. There was a lot of complaints about in London and certain other places it wasn't happening at the weekend there. You know, too many people congregating in parks and things like that. For what I've seen, you know, driving through Scotland today, that seems much more sensible here at the moment. So with a bit of luck, it'll just delay it so that curve that they don't want to hit high stays fairly low.
Yeah.
We live in hope.
I suspect in Scotland you had better messaging because Boris and Dominic Cummings and friends have just made a mess of things, really, on a host of levels. I mean, their initial herd immunity policy, and people have pointed out it's not a policy, it's actually a consequence of things going very badly wrong. There was that initial significant misstep, and then just poor communication from what I could see. I watched a lot of his 5 o'clock briefings, and when you consider that this was the team that came up with all the slogans around Brexit, the many slogans that cut through the atmosphere and got to people, and then, you know, get Brexit done in the election just gone. It's amazing they can't get people to stay at home now or bloody wash their hands. I don't know quite how they failed to come up with a slogan for this.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to get the whole country or a whole nation, whatever, going on the one sort of direction. I think those of us who get it last, you know, the countries that get it later, we get to learn from everyone else. So it's a wee bit, whether that's the population, whether that's the government, whether that's the advisors, the specialists, we all get to say, yeah, we've done it right. So I don't want to be too smug about it that Scotland at the moment, because we might get hit really, really badly with it over the next 2 weeks. But one of the good things is, you know, you get hit, you know, a little bit later. So all the mistakes that were made in the past, you get to learn from them, and maybe you look a little bit better. But maybe had you been hit first, you might have made all the same mistakes.
What have you been doing with your now, what was once football time?
Like everyone else, there was one job that I put off for about 20 years, and I did it. Yeah, I mean, honestly, procrastination at that level. But it's just stuff that we've been, silly stuff. Here, at my fingertips, I have something I prepared earlier. I've been meaning to put things up on my wall in the background here for a long time that are kind of better than a big map over there.
Yeah.
So I got albums and, you know, covers for albums and kind of put them up in frames. So as you will see, you probably know that one. I'm going to test you now.
Don't do that to me.
Can you not see? Oh, you must know who that is.
Yeah, we got that. Okay, Heroes, David Bowie, check.
Right, okay, so I've got...
This is about to get very embarrassing for me, so thank you for that.
Yes, excellent. Next one. Oh, it's because it's old, right? There's a reason why it's old, right? That's actually quite a hard one, maybe.
It looks like a Monet or something like that.
It's probably not close enough. Anyway,
Proclaimers.
Associates, Sulk.
Okay.
Then it gets a little bit weird and a bit strange. So I'll save you that.
All right, okay.
Try to think if there's anything that the general populace will get. So doing all that sort of stuff, if you get that, you get 100 points if you get that. Well done. I don't even know if you can see it with the light.
I can see it well enough to, if I knew what it was, I could tell you, but I don't know.
Good. Right, so my favourite band, the Cocteau Twins. So like everyone, things that you put off for a long, long time, I mean, doing that, so... and it is one of those things where, you know, certain books that you wanted to read,
yeah,
you know, certain movies that you thought, right, that's a DVD in the back of the cupboard that I'll watch one day. You just get round to doing it. There's a million and one things you can do. And also, if in the community here, there's things being set up to help, and we're all putting our names forward here that we can do certain ways that we can help. And whatever it is, you know, particularly the elderly community, it's quite an elderly community around where I live, so a lot of us are putting our names forward and saying, right, when you need us, give us a shout. We're here. And it's nice. Small communities are like that. I mean, I'm sure you've got that all the way through, you know, most of Ireland, but particularly rural Ireland. You will get that. And you get that very much in rural Scotland as well.
From a football point of view, the Euros are gone since we last spoke, which barely mustered a shrug, I think, from most people. I mean, of course, the Euros are gone. And the Premier League delusion to a point continues in that they're still talking about playing off a raft of games in June, which I would be very pessimistic about happening, to be honest. Hopefully I'm totally wrong on that. But the interesting thing is they did decide that they will finish the season regardless of how long it takes. And based not least on our conversation last Monday and just thinking about it myself, that probably is the only way they can do this. Let's just finish this season now that we've started it, and then we can adapt the following season whatever way we need to. And if that, you know, if the adaptions take a year or two to segue back into normality as we know it, then so be it. At least it will be equitable and everyone will know the new reality before the start of the next season. But I think finishing this season probably is the easiest solution to the many complications that even you painted last week, not least this thing ending up in the courts.
Yeah, the courts, and also contracts. You've got different sets of players at the start of the season. For the next season, you just need to waive that. You just need to accept that. And it's just the club, whoever you've got on your books at the time, it may well be it's a different set of players, finishes the season at the start of the season, because contracts will change, all that sort of thing. But we're in a weird world. We need to accept that. I've heard quite a few people now, the suggestion that I was making last week was, look, you're just going to have to squeeze it. When it happens, if you can squeeze it like every other day, you know, people will say, oh, you can't ask the players to play every single day. Well, no, you don't. That's why you've got a squad. That's why you've got a big squad. So you may well have to mix and match it, as teams do these days, because they're, you know, resting players, or, you know, they have to rotate squads. Well, this will be mega rotation, and you might have to do it. So it'll be squeezed a bit. How much it's squeezed, we just don't know. But I'm with you. However, I talked to a couple of people today, one of my journalist friends in Scotland, and he's absolutely of the idea, no, you just abandon. There's no other way around it. You must abandon the season. And I can't see that, but I can't see how that works, and I can't see how legally they get by it. And I just know people will sue, and then this could go on forever. I agree with you. I think there's some way we have to finish it. And by the way, we don't know yet. Nobody knows yet. But when it becomes available, the time becomes available, you squeeze it as much as possible. And Malcolm, for a generation where, you know, three games a week, sometimes four, was kind of doable. You done it. It wasn't perfect, but you done it. Mm. Well, for a period of time, remember, the Premier League, it's got, is it 9-10 games left? You know, you can fit that in 3 weeks maybe, 3 weeks maximum, and you could really get that off and push that off. I know it's not simple, but you might have to logistically do it. And if it means some of those games behind closed doors, then you do it. And I suspect in time, and who knows when that time is, that's exactly where we'll go.
Yeah. And I suspect, I mean, they will be behind closed doors initially. And that's with all the players testing negative and everybody happy to proceed and the PFA happy and everybody happy to play the games in this manner. Somebody did make the not, you know, crazy point that actually it also won't be the worst thing in the world if they can get to a point where those games happen behind closed doors and everybody at home has something to watch for days on end, and it keeps people in their house because, you know, after the weekend we've had, and we had some lovely weather here, and in the main people have been socially distancing, and I think in so much as I can see adhering to the rules in good faith. There were still obviously area bottlenecks, people, you know, long queues for chips, you know, by the seaside here and that kind of stuff. So keeping people at home as this goes on is going to be one of the big issues, because people will get stir crazy. People will just get to a point where they say, oh, screw this. I just need to get out of the house. So anything that maybe makes quarantine or self-isolation a bit more bearable, including Premier League games, then no bad thing, maybe.
Yeah, wall-to-wall Premier League games each day. It's amazing. The first conversations we had about this when this was really kicking off was, let's remember where sport is. It's not really that important in the wider scheme of things. Well, no, it isn't in some degree. But in other degrees, you start realising more and more and more how core a part it is to a lot of people's lives. Mm. And it may well be, you're absolutely right. It will be the time to do it. And sport will have to just bite the bullet. Now, to be honest, I don't think sport will have a problem with that now, in football particularly. Because what they've had to deal with so far, what they've had to change, how they've had to adapt so far, has been absolutely incredible. So this actually, what we're talking about here, eventually happening, I don't think that's a massive big deal to get. It's logistically, it'll be hard. Yes, it will be hard. It's getting players from A to B and all that sort of stuff. All that's going to be difficult. But in time, it's not going to be as difficult as what we're seeing now, which is, you know, the possibility of clubs, leagues, institutions, companies, whatever, imploding. You know, that's nothing. That is massive. That is what we fear. Mm. Getting out the other side of it and doing whatever you need to do, you'll do.
As for football's response, I mean, you kind of get a glimpse of the human side of things. There was a great piece in the New York Times by Rory Smith where he had obviously his sources in the Liverpool camp, and he had detailed the 24, 48 hours around going into lockdown effectively, and you know, stuff that we wouldn't necessarily think of, like Minamino, who's just joined the club and all his family and everybody he knows are on the other side of the world. And it's like, best of luck to you in self-isolation for the next however many weeks. And Jurgen Klopp had said to everybody from, you know, cleaning staff to canteen to players to physios, you all have my number. Call me if you're lonely. You know, trying to cater for the psychological side of this whole thing. But also, you know, Seamus Coleman, for instance, today made a €20,000 donation to Feed the Heroes, which is a charity, I suppose, over here now feeding the frontline workers who are very busy and don't have time to feed themselves. I saw the Man City and Man United players came up with €100,000 between them, donations to food banks. Robert Lewandowski donated €1 million. Like, I don't care how rich you are, €1 million is €1 million, you know. Several Bayern teammates came together to raise millions. You've Gary Neville, Ryan Giggs opening their hotels for NHS staff. Roman Abramovich as well opened the Millennium Hotel at Stamford Bridge. I saw Wilfred Zaha has a company with 50 apartments around London. That is now for NH staff. The Brighton players are phoning the elderly. Footballers are not perfect, clearly, and quite often they are unprepared for the riches and the privilege which is thrown at them, and often misbehave, understandably. They are a cross-section, like so many of us. But you do see there are some really good people in there, and they're doing good things at the moment. And sometimes we kind of underestimate that, or we're a little bit cynical about that.
You are, because you only get a certain side of it in the media, or you did in the past. Social media has tried to push it. You know, they've pushed their own brands, their own personalities, and the good works they've done as well. Having worked inside it for so many years, and from the work with the PFA and work with players, etc., I've watched it for years. It's happened for years, forever, with players. They've helped in various ways. Now, we had it written in the contracts decades ago that there is a certain amount of time that you have to give every week to community. You know, and people are amazed at that still. That's in the players' contracts. They should be doing it. And we as a PFA were the ones that were pushing it. You know, we were trying to get to make sure our players did that. We thought it would help them. But it happens all the time. I went down a little, at the moment, one of my other pastimes, apart from making these LP cover things, is going down these wormholes on YouTube and finding things. And I was looking for a player the other day, and I found out he had, you know, he'd started a hospital over in Brazil, you know, one of the old Chelsea players. And then I started looking at all these other ex-Chelsea players who I was looking for an article. And the amount of them that have done it, they've all started these different regimes all over the world off their own backs. I had no idea. And I work at that place half the time. Mm. And that's just one club. So, yes, you're hearing it now. It's great. But it kind of, to a degree, it's all going on. Go and have a look at what Didier Drogba's done over the years and any other players. Mm. It didn't actually need the coronavirus for that to happen. But it's great that that's coming out now, that people are seeing that. I know what some people will think. They're saying the clubs, a lot of clubs are struggling. The leagues are going struggling. The finances are a mess, even in some of the big companies that are, you know, the Skies or whatever, the BTs, you name it. Well, the players have done quite well over the last number of years. And it's, yeah, they should probably put their hands in the pockets and they should do something. And they're absolutely right to think that. The point is they are. And a lot of them are doing it more. It's that difficult thing. It's a very British thing of you do it quietly, and you don't want to be seen to be doing it because it seemed to be far too showy. Mm. But there's actually nothing wrong with that in these situations that people know. And I've decided that I like Zlatan Ibrahimovic again because I found out what he's doing with the coronavirus, and he's really putting his back into it as well. So it's brilliant to see. But it's not. I mean, I was talking to a random player who I was talking to the other day, Gaetan Bong. Remember him? He played, you know, for was it Crystal Palace? He's now at Nottingham Forest, right? Yeah. And Bong, you know, a player you hardly know anything about. And he's like Minamino. He's actually stuck in Nottingham now. Family on the wrong continent.
Yeah.
But he's stuck. And it's all these stories. But he's still thinking of, well, how can I help the community here? He's only joined that community a month ago. So I think the vast majority of them have got it. They get it through their heads, and it's great to see and it's great to hear. It's why when I hear slight moan-ups, and people do have a moan-up and it's part of it and you have to hold power to account, yeah, we all understand that. But in the midst of it, remember, there's a lot of good things. And most people, and I include, you know, football associations, etc., they're trying to do the right thing.
One thing I was very struck by is that the Manchester players, both City and United, came up with the 100 grand for food banks. And in that New York Times piece I mentioned, Jordan Henderson seemed to get word that the cancellation of games would have a massively detrimental effect on the food banks, which go hand in hand with games. That is not a phenomenon here around our sport, or else I've missed it and I hold my hands up if I have. But if I go to a GAA game here, for instance, I don't associate that with food banks. That seems to be fairly enshrined in the football culture over there. So when you're going to a game, there are food banks, is that right?
It's that you get the advertising, you get people talking about it. One of the things that's not hugely known is that a number of the clubs, if you've got a game, you might not have another home game for another 2 weeks, you've bought in all the food. Mm. Where do you do it? You give it to the food bank.
Okay.
And that's what a lot of them are doing just now. There's another side of it, which I think you have to take on board, is the fact that why have you got food banks? If you've seen the Ken Loach film, a couple of years ago, about the food banks and the effect that, and why they were there and why they shouldn't be there. That's a whole different argument, and Ken's a mate of mine and I'm absolutely on board with him with that. But the fact that these food banks are a part of society, and there's one in my wee town here, it's done in a really respectful way. But yeah, football clubs, they actually do it. They do it on the quiet all the time. It's just, right. You see, I mean, I've told you before, this an organisation I work for called EFDN, the European Football Development Network. That's what they do. They bring in all the good ideas from all the clubs that are involved with community, and we just share the good knowledge for everywhere in Europe, who's doing best with whatever thing, and we share it and bring it all together and pull knowledge and pull ideas. And that's why when I hear people saying, oh, footballers, it's surprising that you hear them doing, and I'm thinking, they're doing it all the time. Right. It's constant. It's amazing. It's huge. You just don't know about it.
And I presume Ken Loach's point is it's a failing of society that these things are necessary.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, yeah. Kevin and I happen to be a film of his movies as well, but the film I, Daniel Blake, and if you're ever want to know about that, you've not seen it, definitely have a go at that. That's the other thing, you're asking about films to watch. Ken Loach back catalogue, I'm going for that as well. It's not cheery, I'll tell you that. It's not always cheery.
It sure isn't.
It's a film about Cantona. I don't know if you ever saw that.
Yeah, I saw it.
Cracker, loved that one. Not many great football films up there. There's another story for you. That's another show for you to do.
He's a favourite of our football films. I'm sure you've done it. We're going to get there. He's honorary Irishman as well for Win the Chakes the Barley, which was really good.
Mm-hmm. He's an honorary Scotsman because he did The Angel's Share, which is the part at the top of the whiskey that disappears. I actually met him about that and talked to him about that. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've got other questions. I'm going to just go into a big long Ken Loach story. Let's get back to the football.
Well, how long is it? Because, I mean, I'm curious.
Right, edit. Right, here we go. So I was making a documentary about football for Radio 5 Live BBC. And it was about number 10s, why we don't have number 10s in football. They come from the UK. And it was all about creativity. And I wanted to speak to someone about creativity. Met up with Ken Loach because he's creative in my mind. Mm. And he was making a film called The Angel's Share. And it was about East End of Glasgow, where I come from. And he said, could you look at it for me and check it out for me in the rushes? And I'm going, yeah. So we watched the rushes and he said, what do you think? I went, brilliant. Everything's perfect. You know, even the accents are almost perfect. And he went, almost? Mm-hmm. I went, yeah. Anyway, it turns out I knew that one of the accents was probably 3 miles wrong. You know, different parts of Dublin have got slightly different accents. And I would know that as a Glaswegian. He was going to change the film for it. I'm going, don't do that. But Ken, he's top man, Ken. Absolute top.
Yeah, sure he is. It doesn't go with scripts, as I understand it. I know that, like, from Win the Chakes the Barley, I remember the interviews around that time. It was improvisation to a point within a structure. So that's
and
how he works.
Not always actors, not always professional actors either. He gets a real naturalism. And that's, you know, that's the style.
I want you to settle for me. We had Mark Lawrenson on the show yesterday, just doing kind of a feature interview about his life and times, and he was you know, brilliant, and that lovely wry wit was to the fore, and he was good. But I was asking him about his partnership with Hansen, and well, he said one first of all, they both did Latin in their O levels, so they would talk Latin on the pitch to each other, which is just a gorgeous thought. But also, he said that he, as in Lawrenson, you know, when they would come off the pitch together, he would get into the dressing room covered in sweat and blood and mud. And Hansen effectively, you know, could take off his perfect kit and fold it up and it'd be ready to go next week. That the man found the game too easy, played squash for Scotland, played golf for Scotland and football, obviously. Is Lawrenson being a bit hard on himself there? I suspect he was.
Hansen adds to it as well. When he's asked about it himself, Hansen always uses the same phrase. He delegated responsibilities. He said that the guy, whoever I was playing with, I got him to do the hard work and do the attacking the ball, etc. And he was good at it. He was brilliant at it. And his reading of the play was superb. And to be honest, one-on-one against Hansen was always difficult. He wasn't actually that quick. He wasn't quick at all, but he was incredibly hard to get by because his anticipation of reading the game was spectacularly good. So, I mean, if actually Alan Hansen tackled you on the ground, it was almost a small victory because you'd actually made him get out of position enough where he had to slide tackle. It almost never happened. So he's actually right. It's a classic one, a big centre-half and an intelligent sweeper, you know, and it's old-school kind of thing in its own way. And Hansen, whoever he played with. The problem was that once went wrong, and it went terribly wrong for Scotland once, because we had a number of great centre-halves. One of our great centre-half pairings was Miller and McLeish, both Aberdeen, both won the European title against Real Madrid with Alex Ferguson. He was up there. But once in Scotland, we decided to put Miller and Hansen together. That was two people who didn't want to attack the ball. It was an utter disaster. Mm. It was the worst pairing in the world. So you do need the two opposites working together. Lawrenson was a good player, a right good player. But Hansen was the one who, no, I'm delegating, you do that work.
Mm. I was just Googling greatest centre-half pairings out of interest to see what would come up of all time. Now, I'm leaving out a couple of famous Italian ones here because I'm just not as familiar with them. But the list I Googled, the first one I clicked on, so you can give me your pairing here that you like the most out of this bunch. They had, shortlisted, they had Desailly and Laurent Blanc. They had Adams and Bold. They gave honourable mention to Keown, but they went with Adams and Bold as the definitive one. Bruce and Pallister got a mention. Carlos Puyol and Gerard Piqué got a mention. Now, I'm not sure, maybe I'm being a bit harsh, but the perception is they didn't have to do very much, which is probably unfair. But Puyol and Piqué got a mention. Vidic and Ferdinand, Baresi and Costa Curta at Milan, and then Maldini and Nesta at Milan as well. What's been your favourite, perfectly balanced centre-half partnership down the years?
So I'll read the ones I've just written down there.
Okay.
The Rio one I agreed with completely. Costa Curta and Baresi, because I was supposed to play against them once me, central centre-forward. I'm sure I've told you about that before. Bold and Adams, I absolutely had down there as well. And another one that doesn't get mentioned, Everton for a period of time in the mid-80s had Ratcliffe. Sometimes they Watson, sometimes Mountfield, and they were spectacular in that way, where Ratcliffe's pace was extraordinary, whereas Degsy would go and attack the ball, and they actually worked brilliantly well, helped by the good people around them as well. I have to say that Pally and Bruce won. Oddly, when you looked at them individually, you just thought, that's not going to be brilliant, but it was. And it was that total understanding of, you know, who did what, and you know, there's plenty of players you play with in your career. Doesn't need to be centre halves. It can be anybody. You just have a pure and perfect understanding, and their understanding grew brilliantly over the years. You mentioned the fact I don't think you could ignore the current, and it's a back three, which is a shame. You know, the Bonucci, Bazzagli, Chiellini. But they quite often just went for a two, and it didn't matter which one of the two it was. And for the best part of a decade there, I think they were streets ahead of anyone else in the world. So I think you have to put them in that as well. There's millions. I'm going miles back. I remember the first one I ever remember was it was Billy McNeil and John Clarke, who played for Celtic, won the European Cup. And I remember watching them just at the end of their career, and it was exactly the same again. Clarke was the intelligence, and Big Billy, King Billy, would just go and attack everything. And John Clarke now, the kit man for Celtic. He's European champion.
He's beneath that. He should be the ambassador, for God's sake.
Exactly. But I think he's such a normal guy. He kind of loves that side of it. But you go through all the years, and it doesn't have to be all brilliant players. And you're right about Keown, because he should have won, because he was that good a defender. He wasn't much of a player, but he was one of the best defenders out there. The other one, which I'm going to throw right back at you, any time playing against McGrath, you thought, well, whoever's playing beside you, it doesn't seem to matter. You know, would it have been Big Mick McCarthy, Ireland, or maybe Kevin Moran? You know, that would be the one you would think of, maybe with McGrath sometimes. But wherever he played, whoever was beside him looked brilliant anyway, because he was fantastic in that centre-back position.
Yeah, he sure was. You don't need to tell us. And I know you said a few times he was the most tricky one-on-one opponent to get round. He was just that good. In terms of partnerships then, so like you would have, very integral to you is probably the left back behind you, maybe a striker. I know John Aldridge and you had a nice little relationship for a time, or central midfielder maybe as well. In terms of those relationships, which are probably in a way the most joyous things about football in some respects, connecting with people in some innate way, was it always innate, or were there people that initially you played with and it was a real struggle to click, but you could vocalise to each other what you wanted from each other and work on it that way? I always just presume there's a certain chemistry and a certain magic that all the cups of coffee and all the work on the training ground can never quite replicate or compensate for, because every set of circumstances is always just that bit different.
It should be like that, right? So there was guys, I remember working with Stevie Clarke, the Scotland manager, him and I, brilliant understanding in the right wing for Chelsea. He was right back, I was right wing, but total belief and understanding. And over the years, I had lots of fullbacks who had really good understanding. Every single club I was at, I manipulated this understanding. Some strikers, I just always knew where they would go. I knew where they liked the ball. You mentioned Alder, but it was Kerry Dixon as well. This guy's probably listening to the show tonight because he lives in Dublin, but David Speedy and I is a classic. It was almost telepathic, the understanding of the pitch. We could not stand each other at all. All right. Just nothing in common. Argued and disagreed, and the opposite characters that you could ever imagine. But on the pitch, it was just completely telepathic. But each of them, what I'm talking about, are just good, normal understandings. Throughout my career, though, I would say there's two, maybe three, where I thought, no, this is it. I finally got it. This is the one. And none of them I ever had the real fortune of spending a lot of time with, and near the end of my time with Everton, Peter Beardsley came and joined us. And in training, it was like, it was phenomenal. Oh, thank goodness, someone who thinks my way. And it was, you know, probably we would both be better suited to the current game than we were to that game at the time. But you were thinking in that sort of way, and I couldn't explain it. It was that easy to beat defences when you were working with somebody with that type of intellect. Another one, oddly enough, was John Collins. And people wouldn't think of him as one of those players, but he was a brilliant player. You know, his time with Celtic, but I played him maybe only 3 or 4 times with Scotland. But honestly, it was a dream, an absolute dream. Everywhere where we went, we didn't even look at each other. And I know it's that classic old one. No need to look. I know where you're going to go. A little glance over to each other. 10 seconds later, we knew where we were. We knew where we'd go. We knew where we'd move. There's very, very few that happened throughout your career. But with John, only played with him a few times. And that's the thing. If you end up at a club where you've got that perfect understanding with somebody like that. I mean, it happened to me again painfully at Tranmere Rovers later in my career. I don't know, we'll throw a name at you, see if you remember it. A guy called Ivano Benetti. No. And he played for Sampa, for Sampdoria for many years. He's a European champion. He's done that. But near the end of his career, he came over to England, played with us for a wee while. I mean, really world-class player, but he's not that well known outside Italy. Ended up being the manager at Grimsby for a while. Anyway, but an amazing player. And he signed for Tranmere, and I'm thinking, wow, at last somebody of that level to work with. He was bought as my replacement. And it's so infuriating that maybe back then you wouldn't stick, you know, like now you would put Silva and De Bruyne and all that together. Yeah. Back then, yeah, we'll have one of them.
Yeah.
Just one of them. You'd never have more than that. And that was what was infuriating for me. But there was different people with different types of understanding. Maybe the best one, you know, back away, way back to Dalglish and Rush was horrible playing against that because nobody seemed to be able to stop them.
And in your instances with Collins or with those players that you connected with, like, is it down to intelligence or when someone like Beardsley comes down, or is it just you see the same pictures? Can you put your finger on it?
It's a type of match intelligence, I think. I can remember once near the end of my career playing at Kilmarnock, and I got the ball and I dribbled around 3 players waiting for the fullback to fly by because I was dragging everybody away, and I turned around as I was just about to be hit by 3 or 4 players. He was standing watching me going, oh, well done, Pat. I'm thinking, thank you. I'm doing this for you.
Yeah.
And then they learned it to do it. There's some people just innately just do it, the right thing all the time and make the right moves all the time. And if you make a run, they will see it. And it's classically, I wasn't in the standard of the guys you mentioned. I like the Silvers and De Bruyne's, but if you make a run, De Bruyne will find you.
Yes, yeah.
You just know he will. So it's that type of match intelligence and that type of vision that many players have it for split seconds or now and again. Certain players have it for a lot of the time. And other players like De Bruyne or whatever have it all the time. And if you get involved with those players and you can work with those players and you have an understanding of those players, it is a brilliant, brilliant thing to have. But they're rare.
Listen, brilliant stuff. We will chat next week. Is there any movie recommendation you want to throw out there for the week that's in it, or book recommendation or album recommendation that will get you through this week?
I'll tell you what, just go for the movie. If you get a chance, you're a football fan and you're missing a lot about football, so there's 2 to go and look for. So go and look for The Miracle of Bern. It's in German, but trust me, it's one of the great football movies ever made. And another one, which I may have mentioned before, Heleno. Again, to put you off slightly by telling you it's Portuguese spoken, it's Brazil, and Heleno was a player who was as famous as Pelé before Pelé, and nobody's ever heard of him.
Okay.
You got to watch the movie to find out why. And by the way, it's a genius movie.
Pat, you're killing me here. I watched Sister Act last night and nothing's going to beat that, to be honest with you.
Okay, I watch Men in Black 3.
All right. Right, go on, see you later.
Have a good one.
All right, bye-bye. Pat and Evan there, back in 1 sec.
Football on Off the Ball. With Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
Now you're welcome back. Miracle of Bern and Heleno were the 2 recommendations from Pat and Evan. Nathan Murphy is standing by. Hello.
Joe Malloy.
Have you seen either of Miracle of Bern or Heleno? Have you seen Sister Act?
I have seen Sister Act many times. Well, great movie.
Okay. Isn't it a great movie?
Uplifting, Joe.
I hadn't seen it in years, and last night we said, you know what, we need a little something. We need a little lift, and we went for Sister Act. And
you didn't say we need a little romance. Let's go for Sister Act.
No. Loads of romance. What are you talking about? So, a few things to get through, a few things going on today. Seamus Coleman, amongst, in fairness, and we touched on this with Pat Nevin, amongst many footballers stepping up to the plate, like Robert Lewandowski donated €1 million of his own money to develop research into COVID-19. Seamus Coleman gave €20,000 donation to Feed the Heroes and does what it says in the tin, that organisation. Over here in Ireland, they feed frontline workers. And he also recorded a short video, which I'm going to play to the listeners now if you haven't heard it. Here's Seamus Coleman.
Hi, Seamus Coleman here. I got a message earlier on this evening from Keith Andrews to make me aware of a GoFundMe page for Feed the Heroes. Feed the Heroes is all our frontline staff who are being so brave at this moment, helping all the sick people due to this horrible disease, COVID-19. I know it's a tough time at the minute, but we will get through this. Stay positive, keep fighting. If anyone can make any donations towards the page, it would be great, small or large, just anything to, as I said, feed our heroes who are putting themselves on the front line. If you can, as I said, donate towards the page. I'm going to make a donation myself, and I'm so proud of all our frontline workers. And I just want to say thank you on behalf of myself, my family, and everyone in Ireland. Thank you very much.
There we are, Seamus Coleman, and good on him, Nathan Murphy, I guess is all you can say.
Yeah, good leadership from Seamus Coleman. I know Keith Andrews was probably ringing around a few of the Irish players to alert them, and having the Irish captain come out and listen, it's a very sizable donation he's made, but also the publicity he brings to this. And it's not the first time. You might remember with the Sean Cox Fund, he went and he made a sizable donation to that as well, as Everton captain for what would be seen as a Liverpool charity, but obviously it shouldn't really matter, and he sort of recognised that as well. So, yeah, it's a mark of a man, and I don't think anyway's surprising for anyone that knows Seamus Coleman.
And obviously, look, this is just so serious in so many ways. There was a brilliant interview this morning on News Talk Breakfast with somebody who had been infected with COVID-19 and was talking about just how sick he was. Young person, perfectly healthy, and Lee Duffy, the ex-League of Ireland player, has done an interview as well. He was hospitalised, 28 years of age, and he was on Twitter on Saturday evening talking about how he had been unable to breathe without a ventilator. Warned against the public taking this whole thing lightly. He said, as some of you may not know or may know, I tested positive. I spent 8 days in hospital. I was hooked up to oxygen. I could no longer breathe on my own. Very scared, not knowing what was going to happen. Luckily, I got through it, starting to feel better now. My advice to everybody, please do not take this lightly. It is very serious. And we can all heed that. Although Alan Quinlan on OTBM this morning told Jaron Owen a story about seeing three lads in their 30s outside McDonald's drinking out of the same can.
Jesus. Yeah, I think we were all sort of sucked in to the stories a month, 3 weeks ago that, well, this was an old person disease in the sense that if you got it and you were in your 30s, 40s, you'd be fine. You'd shrug it off. It'd be a mild flu, a bad cold. But I think everything we've seen over the past few weeks is that, well, actually, even if you're in your 30s, 40s, you've no idea how your body's going to react. Yeah, you're more likely that your immune system will kick in, but you have no idea how your body's going to react. And when you talk about like someone like Lee Duffy, who's a sportsman in the peak of his fitness, and how it just ground him down, like it's pretty frightening. And if people haven't woken up by now, which, I don't know, you don't want to be overly critical of some of the things that we're seeing yesterday, where there's a lot of people at parks and listen, the queuing up for a takeaway is just insanity. But, you know, people are encouraged to get out. There's only so many places to go. But you would have thought that most people would be smart enough that when they arrive somewhere and they see that there's a queue of cars for half a mile, that you turn back and go somewhere else. Ironically, I went to the Phoenix Park on Saturday. And if you stayed off the main stretch on the Phoenix Park, if you went off the side, it was pretty much empty.
Yeah, I mean, it does not have to be a magical family day out and perfect in every way. Just get out, get some air. I know in a couple of countries you're allowed exercise within 20 minutes of your home, you know, jogging distance, and that's just the way to keep everybody vaguely apart. So you suspect that's going to have to come in here if you see scenes of that many people queuing up for a bloody bag of chips again.
Yeah, and listen, I think everything we know and everything we've seen around Europe suggests that the lockdown is coming, and it's going to be stricter and stricter over the coming weeks, and it's probably going to be brought forward because of the stupidity of a minority of people. I do think most people are adhering to it as much as possible and are going to their parks and staying spread out, but like, it isn't a holiday. Maybe it doesn't help. In one way, it feels like it helps that the weather is good and you can sort of get out in your back garden and front garden, but I think the fact that it was a Sunday, there's the stress and everybody, they just want to get out of the house, probably all came together and people lose the run themselves a little bit.
A few things to touch on. Mikel Arteta's done an interview. This feels like a long time ago since that Thursday evening when Mikel Arteta tested positive, which signalled the end for the Premier League. So he has said he's recovered very well and yeah, I feel I've recovered fully, and Arsenal have about 100 employees, so they're not going to come in for another 14 days, and he's back on his feet and doing well. We had Mark Lawrenson on the show yesterday, and the commentator and you will be interested in this, I suspect. So one of the key questions to ask Mark Lawrenson, who has worked with boatmen, is John Motson or Barry Davies?
Motson. And the reason I'm a Motson man, because he said I kind of resurrected his career when I started commentating with him. I mean, I used to call Barry Lord Barrington of Davies because he was from definitely from like upper class stock, but they were just completely different. And I remember my first ever TV commentary was with Barry, and it was Liverpool. Must have been a European game, and Niall Sloan said to me, he said completely different from radio. He said less is more, and I said, yeah, okay, Niall, not an issue. Anyway, I think I spoke about four times in the whole of the commentary, and I said, you weren't wrong about less is more. He said, well, not really supposed to be, but that was just Barry. And I got on famously with both of them. I really enjoyed the company, but Motson.
Really?
He was raving mad, by the way.
Is he?
Oh, he was, honestly, he was one of those commentators. Everyone said to him about, you know, the statistics and all that kind of stuff, but he never, ever, ever got anything wrong. He always got the moment right as well, but he'd be a nightmare before you actually started.
Right.
And I learned quickly that, you know, he used to get there ridiculously early, 2.5 hours before the game, and I'd go and say hello to him just so he knew I was there. And I would just leave him to do what he did, and he'd be down the tunnel, he'd be asking, you know, everybody, what's the team, did it, all those kind of stuff, and have himself in such a state, and he'd be up on the commentary position. And I would just literally be up there 10 minutes before, and all we had a conversation about was, I would say to him, how do you pronounce this name? So I just said, if we both pronounce it the same, it doesn't really matter and stuff. But he was, once he got to the altar, he was absolutely outstanding. But getting him there wasn't easy. And there was a lot of people who kind of tried to kind of look after him before games, and they soon went down the road.
There we are, Motson, a complete nightmare. And then we went on to talk about, you know, right out of the school of Murphy. Typical.
Yeah, I remember reading Motson's autobiography, and he spoke about how nervous he would get ahead of matches, even at the latter stages of his career. And maybe that feeds into what Mark's talking about, just always this edge around the game and wanting to be prepared. Mark went for Motson, was it because that basically Motson gave him a compliment? Is that what Mark's saying? Motson gave him the compliment ahead of Davies?
I'm a Davies man, I have to say. I'd be Barry Davies all day long. I never quite got the Motson thing. I know that is sacrilege, I'm sure, but I just never quite did.
And I know Mark said that Motson always got the moment, yet it doesn't feel as though he has as many moments as Davies, even though he commentated on probably more big occasions, certainly in football, and what was it, he had 16 FA Cups in a row before Davies got his first one. But like, you think of Os Motson's line, the crazy gang beating the culture club, it's probably the best of them. Mm. Whereas Davies was just maybe a bit more natural, like, that just look at his face line.
Yeah,
it's just responding. You feel that you could have scripted, and maybe it was the crazy gang beat the culture club in advance. Whereas Davies had a brilliance of just reacting, and also had a variety of sports, whether it was tennis or ice skating or any Olympic event. Like, his voice just had this soothing manner.
Yeah,
that like less is more is what Mark said there. Just sums him up. That like, he had this gravitas that he was happy to just let the pictures do the talking. Whereas I think Motson probably did a little bit more radio as well at times.
Elsewhere, because I was reading on the Saturday night before Lawrenson was on yesterday, and it's worth a download, by the way. It's just, if you like Lawrenson and all his kind of his wit and the stories he tells, then it's worth a listen if you're stuck for something. But elsewhere, I was reading a different interview he had done, and this didn't come up yesterday, but he was saying Motson was so highly strung that they were doing one game and the sun was setting quite low, And it was also, it was really hot, you know? And it's about 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes before kickoff. And Motson turns to Lawrenson and points at the sun in their eyes. And he says to Lawrenson, do something about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, his autobiography is one of these books that, like, it's maybe it's too honest because you don't, at the end of it, you're not going, ah, what a great guy. Like, right. he's a bit too frank and open, and at times it doesn't reflect well on himself. And I remember he talks about his relationship with Davies and the first time Davies got a big game ahead of him.
Yeah.
And he spoke about, oh, well, I was very upset, but I had other things to worry about because he'd a broken toe because at a match, again, they were set up in a commentary position, but when they got there, the commentary position had been moved 4 or 5 seats back, and he'd lost a rag and kicked something in anger and broke his toe.
Mm.
He's like, so I had this in my mind as well as Barry Davies. There's a lot of, he doesn't really delve into the Davies relationship in the autobiography. It's, he sort of mentions that there was a rivalry,
yeah,
and that maybe they weren't the most pally, but it was, there was never much talk of the sort of probably jealousy that was involved on either side.
I'd say it must have been like obsessive for both of them. Like every big game that's bloody coming up, who's going to get it, you know? World Cup finals and like this weird thing where at that stage, the FA Cup was a bigger tournament than the European Cups. So Davies' consolation prize was to do the European Cup finals. You know, that's all changed now. But I would presume every month or every 2 months when the roster was coming out, there was just this constant sense of what's he getting, what am I getting?
You have to imagine so. And I think maybe Motson took it a bit more seriously than Davies, that sort of rivalry. I know you did a piece with Barry Davies a couple of years back that's definitely well worth a listen as well. And he just seemed a lot calmer and maybe took things in his stride. Now, maybe he just hit it better.
Yeah.
But it is funny how it turned in that. And maybe that's why, in many ways, you sort of remember Watson's voice a bit more clearly at times when it comes to football, because he did the FA Cup, yeah, which was the biggest game.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't think in this country, I don't remember ever watching too many European Cup games on the BBC.
No, same. Did you see Daniel Taylor's piece on The Athletic about Alex Ferguson?
I did.
This is very good, is it not?
Have you read the book?
No.
So Daniel Taylor,
book he was banned for.
Yeah, he wrote a book about 13, 14 years ago. This is the one, which is one of the best chronicles of life as a football writer in England. I remember getting it at the time and just been absolutely fascinated and shocked at what a football writer would go through, because I would have looked at Daniel Taylor as, and he is, possibly the foremost football writer and best football writer in England.
Like, yeah,
just the way he has of weaving a story together. And I'd imagine it's something that the general public would love, but particularly as a journalist who loves the Premier League and loves going to games, like the insight into Ferguson and just at times what a bollocks he could be, and how weirdly they all just accepted it and thought, you know, there's something good deep down there. Like, for Daniel Taylor in his position at the time as basically Manchester United correspondent to find himself banned from press conferences for 6 or 7 years, like, it's incredible.
It's a serious penalty. Yeah, it was until Ferguson's retirement. I mean, who knows when that ban would have been lifted. This piece in The Athletic is really well worth reading. He charts like the period with Ferguson, especially before Ferguson decided to pool the chats he would have with the journalists, the written press, with the broadcasters. So once that happened, basically, he said, just all the kind of the Ferguson tirade stopped because he knew he was on camera. But it charts the that before they merged together. And like, it's just, there's just brilliant stuff in it. Like, he just goes through story after story, basically. There was that time he eviscerated another member, like, this is the latest in how many stories, another member of the press corps outside the Cliff, United's old training ground, only to realise the entire scene had been witnessed by an assortment of mums, dads, children and autograph hunters. Ferguson at least had the decency to apologise, albeit with a rather glorious explanation. He said, it's the only language these CUNTSs understand.
Yeah. Yeah, like, it did feel as though that time around when Taylor wrote the book that Ferguson was particularly on edge, because it wasn't long after what happened with Roy Keane. At one stage, Ferguson banned MUTV. He banned their own in-house TV station because they were critical of him. And it was, I think, Wayne Rooney was sent off in a match in the Champions League and the presenter sort of questioned Rooney's temperament. Somehow Ferguson found out and went absolutely apoplectic rage.
Mm.
Yes, like, it's their own in-house TV company. So like nobody was ever safe. And Taylor in his book touched on that even though I think he probably ended up on the receiving end of one of the longest bans,
yeah.
Like, not a week went by where somebody wasn't banned from the press conference.
No. He didn't tend to like newcomers, says Taylor in this piece. He always seemed more suspicious when it came to what he saw as the younger generation. One guy who was in his mid-30s, married and with kids, covered a game for the Daily Star. He held out his hand to introduce himself, only for a look of complete amazement to cross Ferguson's face. Jesus Christ, do they get them straight from school these days? Said Ferguson. And the day Keane left, I was interested in as well. The day they turfed Keane out of the club. This is quite amazing, really.
Mm.
So he says, none of us had a clue that Keane's contract had been ripped up earlier that morning. And it was a pleasant little session that day. He's talking about the press conference. Ferguson joked about Scotland winning the unofficial World Cup and seemed tickled that Jose Mourinho, then Chelsea manager, had refused to see the press that week. I might join him. Christ, it's not easy seeing you lot every week. He made a few more jokes, cheery as you like, answered all our questions, and then he shooed us out within a few minutes. Literally before we had even got to the snack bar 400 yards along the next lane, the statement dropped from Old Trafford. Keane, 12 years a United player, finished at the club. That was the other thing about Ferguson. He was a brilliant actor. Al Pacino would have been proud of his work that day. So it's full of like great stuff like that. Ferguson does not come across well for huge chunks of it, like some really vicious tirades and definitely some un-PC stuff that if he said today, he just like it'd be a massive, massive issue. But then, as you always hear with Ferguson, Taylor gives loads of these examples of like, you know, David Meek, the Manchester Evening News journalist, falling ill, and Ferguson coming around to his house and spending the whole afternoon with him and telling stories and trying to cheer him up, or sending flowers to other members of the press who'd fallen ill. So this like mishmash. And he just says like he is by a distance the most interesting person ever in football.
That like that's what made him so brilliant, because he describes him as the most ruthless bastard you would ever meet.
Yeah.
But to be a successful manager and as successful as Ferguson, you can't be like that 24/7.
Mm.
You can't have this absolute reign of fear. There needs to be a human side that can come out from time to time that brings people along with you. You can see by reading that, though, why Roy Keane would be so bitter as well about how things went, because Ferguson's ruthlessness was, when you were of no use to him, he just moved on.
Yeah.
And he was able to move on, where Keane wasn't.
Mm.
Like, Keane wasn't able to let it go. Whereas Ferguson, somehow it seems, and even still, was. He was just another player.
Mm.
But I would definitely recommend, I'm sure you can get the book in probably any bookstores that are selling online at the moment, or get it for Kindle, if you're not just a Manchester United fan, as an insight into how a journalist can cover a football club, and also probably one of the best insights into Ferguson, because it is on an almost, for 2 years, a day-by-day basis of flights with the team to a Champions League match, press conference afterwards, flight back. Like, it's sort of relentless, but it's kind of fascinating because you do get that insight into all of his sort of quirks and peculiarities. And I think an awful lot of people, because it's like so much of what we judge managers on is that press conference, or is that Jeff Shreve's interview for 3-4 minutes after a match. And some of them you can tell are brilliant at getting out a message. But that Ferguson would go and do an off-camera piece with the journalists, all of whom he would have known, say, like it was the regular gang probably of 7 or 8 of them, so he would know them well,
yeah,
and just let loose in a way that you would never see. I don't remember too many times, aside from the one or two obvious ones, where Ferguson cursed in public.
Yeah.
So to get that level of insight and that other side of him that, listen, everybody has that side, I guess, that if you knew it was in public, you would act slightly different.
No, it's true. And Taylor does say in this piece on The Athletic, he was clever. None of his explosions of temper ever caught on camera. And as such, I don't think people truly understand the malevolence of those rages or what it could be like for the football writers when it was just him and us. And he finishes by saying, I miss those Fridays, to be honest. The good outweighed the bad, even if it was a close-run thing sometimes. Because, frankly, it just wasn't dull, is his point. We should actually do, for the hell of it, we should get Taylor on to go through some of the best bits, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, like as he says, that side he managed to keep away from the cameras probably feeds into what a lot of people feel in the Ferguson-Keane rift, because they have seen Keane and they've seen Keane still raging and raging more than a decade on, whereas Ferguson, by and large, has managed to hold his counsel. Now, he's been obviously out of the public spotlight for quite a bit of it, but all you see is the one side of this angry, angry man. And you can't, and angry with this sort of aging football manager who I think at that stage, particularly in the latter years at United, there was a general warmth towards.
Yeah.
And you're wondering, like, well, clearly there's only one villain here. Whereas I think if you look at this and you see the other side a bit more of Ferguson, It took two to tango.
Yeah, it sure did. We're pretty much out of time. Anything else catching your eye today, or will we reconvene tomorrow?
I think we'll reconvene tomorrow, Joe. Okay. Let's not use all the good stuff on Monday.
Yeah, this is true. Day one of week two. Nathan Murphy, thanks very much. Take it easy.
All right, Joe, take it easy.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.